On this edition of Celebrating Science, Professor Leonard Mlodinow on the nature of chance and probability. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Drunkard's Walk, writer and scientist Leonard Mlodinow discusses how randomness, change, and probability reveal a tremendous amount about our daily lives, how we may misunderstand the significance of everything from a casual conversation to a major financial setback. In examining the nature of chance and revealing the psychological illusions that may cause one to misjudge the world around them, Mlodinow also provides tools to make more informed decisions. Dr. Mlodinow received his doctorate in physics from the University of California, Berkeley in 1981. He was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute and now teaches about randomness to future scientists at Caltech. His books include Euclid's Window, The Story of Geometry from Parallel Lines to Hyperspace, Feynman's Rainbow, A Search for Beauty in Physics and in Life, and with Stephen Hawking, A Briefer History of Time.
Thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank the Perimeter Institute for inviting me to come and talk about randomness. I'll start the talk the way I started the book, since it's about randomness, with a story about the lottery, in particular the Spanish National Lottery. There was a fellow who won that lottery some years ago with a number that ended in the digits 4-8, and he didn't believe that he won the lottery through luck. He thought it was his system that led him to pick the particular digits that he picked. And when he was asked why he picked the digits 4-8, he said, well, that's easy. For 7 nights in a row, I dreamt of the number 7, and 7 times 7 is 48. So, well, he made a mistake that's somewhat obvious to us, but my point is that in life, as we perceive what's the events that are going around us, we all make mistakes that are equally as important, but maybe not so obvious. And so that's why I wrote the book, and that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. So I start or continue with a quote from Bertrand Russell. I don't usually read from this screen, but this one's worth it. We all start from naive realism, the doctrine that things are what they seem. We think that grass is green, that stones are hard, and that snow is cold. But physics assures us that the greenness of grass, the hardness of stones, and the coldness of snow are not the greenness, hardness, and coldness that we know in our experience, but something very different. Now, Russell was talking about some of the breakthroughs in modern physics in the early 20th century, but I think it applies just as well to our understanding of the world around us once we understand how randomness works. So let me say that a random process, it's good to start by defining what that means, and that's something that has no definite outcome. So if you have some process going on and you can say exactly what's going to happen, then that's deterministic. But if there are more than one possibility and all you can do is give different probabilities for them, even though they may not be equally probable, we'll call that a random process. And it's important to realize that randomness is context dependent. So suppose that you're flipping a coin. If you can control your thumb perfectly well, and you can control how you place the coin on your thumb and how far you are above the table and all the other different variables, then theoretically, you should be able to flip the coin either heads or tails every time. And there are people who claim that they can do that. But for us, a coin flip is kind of an archetype for a random process because we can't do that. So in the context of a person or a machine that can control every factor and isolate the system, that's not a random process. But in the context of a situation where you don't have control, over all the elements, then it is a random process. And I say here, except quantum randomness, because there is one, on one level of nature, where randomness is built in our everyday world, which follow Newton's laws. Theoretically, if you knew all the initial conditions and you know Newton's laws, you can predict the future exactly, as far out as you want. The reason we can't do that is that we don't know all the initial conditions, and we can't isolate our systems so perfectly that other factors don't influence them. And quantum theory tells us, though, that even if you can do that, the future is only determined with different probabilities. And I'm not going to go into that tonight, but maybe in the questions if you want, or afterwards we can talk about that. So the book is called The Drunkard's Walk. Drunkard's Walk is actually a mathematical term, and it also describes certain mathematicians at times. But it's also called a random walk. And it's a term that describes a random process whereby something moves in different directions randomly. And this is just an example of one that I generated on the computer. But it shows us a few characteristics. One is that even though it's random, sometimes it seems to go in a certain direction, as if it had the intent to go in that direction. Also, it seems to dwell at places, right? So if you didn't know it was random, then you might think, if you were watching someone, you might think the person's here because they're hanging out there because there's a reason for it, or they're going this way because they plan to. But actually, even random processes have those characteristics. And they also go from point A to point B. They get somewhere, okay? So this is a good metaphor for what happens in life. A lot of times we see things that we interpret because we're made to interpret them that way, and I'll talk about that more. But we interpret them as having a certain meaning, where actually there's a large component of randomness that we don't understand. So tonight I'm going to talk about, I had to pick just a few topics, so three sets of illusions. The first is the illusion of small numbers, which is all about the fact that the results that we observe in real life of people striving for things, with opening businesses, investing in different investments, in sports, or in your real life, you don't observe a large number of instances of trials, and that the number that you do observe isn't really large enough to draw the conclusions that we do. The second is the Monty Hall illusion. I'll explain what that is, but if you remember Monty Hall, it has to do with a certain TV show that was on many years ago. But in a broader sense, it has to do with what we call conditional probability, which is how the probabilities of things change when you get more information or different conditions are put on. And that has great applications, very important applications in daily life, especially in medicine. And unfortunately, it's something that doctors often get wrong and cause a lot of heartache and bad decisions. And finally, I'm going to talk about some psychological illusions. So those are not mathematical illusions, but there's some of the reasons that we don't understand randomness and we have a hard time understanding its role in life. And they're very subtle factors that often play out subconsciously. So we might say, I know this is random. And then when psychologists do the experiment and probe, you behave as, even though you might know it's random, you behave as if you believe that it's not random. So there's some fun studies there. So the illusion of small numbers, the psychologists call this the law of small numbers. Being a scientist, I don't like to call something that's wrong a law, so I call it just a little prejudice I have. So I call it the illusion of small numbers. And the illusion of small numbers is the idea that the law of large numbers, a real law, applies to small numbers. Now, the law of large numbers says roughly that if you have an underlying probability of something happening, and you do, and you let the process, you observe a zillion instances of that process, that the probability of the results will probably reflect themselves in the closely in the results. So if you're flipping a coin and the coin is weighted to be 60% heads, and if you do it a zillion times, you'll probably get nearly 60% heads. But that doesn't mean that if you do it five times, you will. And that's the mistake people make. So let's look at a certain example. Suppose that in some field you have a certain ability, resources, effort that you're willing to put in, and that this leads to a probability of success on each trial of 60%. Okay, now success is determined not just by the all the factors that are laid out and that you prepare, but also by events generally in life that you can't control or you can't predict or you can't measure. So that's why it has there, different things can happen. It's rare in life that we start something and know exactly what's going to happen as a result. So we can describe it using the theory of randomness. And I'm just saying, suppose that your probability is 60%. So as an example, let's take a five-year period, and suppose that all the companies have a 60% chance, all the companies of the Fortune 500 have a 60% chance of success in any given year, or that all the CEOs have a 60% chance in a given year. Let's suppose that they're all identical, and they all have this percentage of chance, okay, of being successful in a year. Now, if you look at 5 years, if they have a 60% chance of being successful, that translates to 3 good years out of 5. So now the question is, okay, suppose that that were the case. Now we look at the results. What should we expect? How often will we see that that these people or these companies that have a 60% chance of having success will have 3 out of 5 good years, as that should translate to? Or how often do they have 1 good year, 2 good years, or some other number that makes them seem worse or better than they are? Well, here's the graph. So the chances only of 3 out of 5 good years are only 1 in 3. That means that 2/3 of the time, the results will inaccurately reflect the underlying probability. Okay, now you might say, that seems strange. Let me point out, if you look at the red bar, that it's true that the most likely single occurrence is that you will indeed have 3 good years out of 5. But there are many other occurrences, okay? So that's about 1/3 of the time. And 2/3 of the time, you'll have results that don't reflect the underlying probabilities. In fact, 1/10 of the time, you'll have either 5 good years or 5 bad years in a row. So if you look at the Fortune 500, if they are all identical companies with a 60% chance of success, and you look at them over 5 years, you'd find that 50 of those companies had 5 good years in a row or 5 bad years in a row, even though they were identical to all the other companies. So effects like that cause us to have certain illusions and to believe certain things that aren't really true. One is called the hot hand fallacy. And this often is something that comes up in sports. When you see your favorite basketball player makes 8 or 10 free throws in a row, you think and the commentators say that person is hot. Or I show Joe DiMaggio here, who had 56-game hitting streak. And there's a lot been written about the psychological grit that it took to continue that hitting streak and how that stands out in the history of sports as the most impressive streak of all. And then you have managers, Joe Torre there, who did really well with the Yankees, then had some bad years. Well, bad, I lived in New York for a while. Bad in New York standards means he didn't win the World Series. So every book is a bad book if it's not Harry Potter, I guess. So, I looked into that and I said, and a lot of researchers have looked into that and done analyses and said, well, let's compare the randomness and let's see if these things can be explained by randomness, or if they can't, then we're pretty sure that there's something else going on. So these are the three examples. But basketball has been studied a lot, and they found that the streaks in basketball players are completely consistent with their with randomness. So if you're, let's say, you might not be a 50% free throw shooter, you might be a 75 or an 80% or not 85% free throw shooter. If you take a coin and weight that 85% heads and then flip it for a whole basketball season equivalent, you'll find the same kinds of streaks that we find in real games. Another study looked at specifically at the probability of making a basket, if these two teams, if over a certain season, the probability of them making, or I think they looked at each player, the probability of making a basket if they had made the previous basket versus the probability of making a basket if they had missed the previous basket, and they were the same. So there was no evidence of anything that's not random that's going on. But when I say random, I don't mean talent doesn't matter. As I said in the free throw example, if you have an 80% average, then you'll make on the average 8 out of 10, and randomness tells you what kind of streaks you could have. If you're a 0% free throw shooter, then you'll make on the average 0, and the laws of randomness still confirm that you will never make one. So one record I talk about in my book is the Roger Maris home run record, where which was a good example because that Roger Maris never hit more than 39 home runs in a year. It doesn't matter if you don't know baseball. He never did more than 39 of some good thing in a year. And that one year that he hit 61, broke a record with his beloved fellow named Babe Ruth. And people gave him a lot of criticism because he didn't do well after that, whereas Babe Ruth was great his whole career. And Maris apparently cracked up. But if you do a random model of that, you'll find that there are many players of Roger Maris's ability over the years, which is a much lesser ability than Babe Ruth, and yet the randomness, random mathematics shows you that there will be fluctuations above their average, and there have been enough of them over the years that you should have expected somebody of that lesser ability to hit that many home runs, even if they were just flipping coins. And in the case of Joe DiMaggio, it was a very interesting study done at Cornell University, I think as a hobby by two researchers, where they modeled baseball every year from 70-something to 2005. They took the actual statistics and used that as a model for each player, and then they, let's say figuratively, designed a coin for each player for each year to represent what their ability was that year, okay? And then they replayed the entire 130-year history of baseball 10,000 times. They generated 10,000 parallel universes in which all the players in each parallel universe had the same ability based on their ability, based on the best that we know of their ability based on their statistics, okay? But yet, it was played out randomly. Okay, so the laws of randomness caused fluctuations around their ability. And what they found was that in about half of these 10,000 histories of baseball, the hitting streak that was achieved was greater than or equal to DiMaggio's. His was 56. And that happened about half of the history. So it wasn't really, so if you have a player of DiMaggio's talent and you have a lot of them playing every year, eventually chances are one of them is going to have a streak like that, even if there's nothing special about them that year. The longest streak was 109, which was about double that. And by the way, DiMaggio, obviously, he didn't set this record in all 10,000 of these histories. He did it only about, I think, 50. Actually, curiously, I think he did it in 56. So the record was 56, and he did it 56 times. So read something into that. Other players who are better hitters set it more often. So the chances were that the record would be around 56 and would be set by somebody else. But in our real world, he set it and he gets the kudos. And another interesting study based on this sort of thinking was that when a sports team does poorly, quite often the blame goes to the coach. Actually, in sports, probably less than the credit. The blame goes to the coach, whereas in business, the credit goes to the CEO, but often not the blame. Well, someone did a study across all sports to see if the teams actually did better on average after they fired their coach, and the answer was no. So, and if you want the references, they're all in the back of the book. What about track records? So this is, I talked about streaks and records, records of outstanding performance that are above the normal performance, but what about track records? How meaningful are they? When we invest in a mutual fund, we normally look back at the last 3 or 5 years and see how that fund performed compared to others, and we assume that they can perform just as well in the future. We're saying the sample of 5 is a good enough sample to tell us what their underlying quality is of the managers or of their investment strategy. So the question is, let's see if that's really true. If we look backwards in time, we can answer that. So here I have ranked the 800 mutual funds for a 5-year period, 1991 to 1995. And the top fund is here and had a return relative to the average of them of about 20%, and the worst fund is down at the end. So if this was deterministic, or close to deterministic, if these funds were really, it reflected the underlying strategy and abilities of the people who ran them, if you could really, for instance, predict the stock market and they were doing it, better at the left and worse at the right, then if you look at the next 5-year period, the graph should look pretty much the same. So let's see what the graph actually looked like. So it's kind of like random noise. Now, and I did it I looked at many different periods. And so what this tells you is that it's not enough time to tell the difference. It doesn't mean that it's easy to say, they did really badly the last 5 years, I'm going to buy their fund. But it tells you that relying on that is a very dangerous thing. And that should be raising a question in your minds, which is how long do you have to observe to know what's underlying, what the underlying qualities are. So let's go back to sports. I like sports, to use sports examples, for a few reasons. One is that they have definite rules, and they have like umpires and referees who make sure they get followed, okay, which doesn't happen in real life. Neither happens in real life. And also, they're all the statistics of everything imaginable are taken and kept and are accurate, which is also not true of real life. So it's interesting to use sports examples. But suppose that you have a championship series, the Stanley Cup or something, and suppose that one team, the superior team, has a 55-45 edge, meaning that if they play, by the law of large numbers, if they played a zillion games, you can be confident that they'd win about 55% of those, and the lesser team would win about 45%. But now we're not going to play a zillion games. And by the way, I think that's a pretty big edge. I mean, usually in the championship series, the teams are fairly closely matched. So now we play a best of X series, 7-game series, for instance. So the question is, you can probably guess, what is the approximate probability that the inferior team will win in a 7-game series? You can probably guess that it's pretty great, right? This 7-game series is not enough. And yes, it's 40%. So the world champion has a 40% chance if the teams are truly comparable in this level that the lesser team won the series. So the next natural question is to say, what if we want to have what's called statistical significance, which means a 5% or less chance that we're wrong, or that is that the lesser team will win this World Series or this Stanley Cup? How many games do we need to play to have that low, be that certain that we're getting it right? Anyone want to shout out? Okay, let's look. Ta-da! 269. So I think that all the sports channels would give up probably after. and I don't think many people would be viewing it anymore. And that's fine, because sports isn't meant to be a science, and it's much more fun when it's not one. But we just have to keep in mind that it's not, and that the best team doesn't always win. And so it is in life, too. Talking about life, I have one more example in this vein. That's Bill Miller. Bill Miller was called, here you see, the greatest money manager of our time and other great things, and praised very much in the press because he had a 15-year winning streak where his mutual fund that he ran beat the Standard & Poor's Index for 15 years in a row. So you can imagine that as opposed to an index fund that doesn't charge much, actively managed funds charge you a good bit for their expertise. And a fellow who runs one that's beats the Standard & Poor's for 15 years in a row gets a lot of good press and makes a lot of money and has a good time. Here are some of the things, other things that were said. Actually, there was one article, I couldn't find it when I was going back through them, but one article said the odds were 4 billion to 1, something like that, that it would be achieved by chance. And so let's see. Let's look at it. I mean, I think comparing his feat to what could happen by chance is a very sound thing to do. In science, when you're looking for it to see if an effect is real, one thing you do is you compare it to a random process. You say, what are the chances it would come up if there was no effect, but through randomness alone? So let's test the Bill Miller had talent hypothesis. So I'm saying that I'm going to compare this to some people flipping coins. Okay, so there are about 5,000 or 6,000 mutual fund managers, one of the articles said there about 1,000 were comparable to Miller's fund, and I want to be conservative. So I said, let's say there's 1,000 of them. And let's say they're not managing stocks at all. They're flipping a coin once a year. If it's heads, they beat the Standard & Poor's. If it's tails, they didn't. You could probably do that just by buying up the Standard & Poor's and picking a stock at random to delete from it. You'd probably get a 50% chance of beating it or not beating it. So let's say they were doing that, and there were 1,000 of them doing that every year, okay? That's what's happening. And let's take the last, let's say, 40 years. We have to take some time frame. And since the articles talked about 40 years as being the era of modern mutual funds, I think that's a good time frame. It might sound like a lot, but you can't even fit 3 of these streaks back to back in 40 years. It's really not that long compared to the 15 that we're looking at. So I said, suppose that there's 1,000 of these people every year flipping a coin for the last 40 years. So what are the chances? Well, what are the chances that one in particular one, like Bill Miller, would have a 15-year streak, would have a streak 15 years in a row from 1991 to 2006? That's 1 in 2 to the 15th, so it's about 1 in 30,000. But then when you factor in that there was 1,000 managers that are trying to do this. He said, what are the chances that 1,000 managers, of 1,000, one of them, not particularly this guy or that guy, but one of them would beat it for 15 years in a row, at least, or more, starting in 1991 still. The chances are, in other words, starting in one particular year, the chance is about 3%. So it's still pretty low. So if they all started in 1991, 1,000 of them, and they all flipped the coin over the next 15 years, there's a 3% chance that one of them would have had this feat. Okay, but again, it doesn't matter they started in 1991. We need to look over the whole period. So what are the chances that if they are all doing this for 40 years, that somewhere in there someone would have a 15-year streak or more? And that comes out to about 3 out of 4. So if Miller didn't have this streak, you'd say, what are these guys doing? He could do better by chance alone, right? So it's a good thing that someone had that streak. So my idea that if the press really understood this, the headline wouldn't be the greatest money manager of our time, but it would be expected 15-year run finally occurs, Bill Miller lucky beneficiary. let me go back. Okay, there's a sorry epilogue to this. Okay, in 2007 it didn't, and his fund didn't do so well, and his fund did really abysmally in 2008. So this is what they're writing about him now. I think he picked AIG, great Bear Stearns. The fund went down 58% compared to 20 for the Standard & Poor's. So that I think that red graph says it all. And I think this is characteristic of when something's happening through. The guy is a smart guy. Everyone I think agrees that he's a smart guy. But if his smartness was what was causing the streak, then it wouldn't change overnight. Now, you could argue that it could change overnight because the climate, his smartness plus the philosophy caused a streak, so, and the climate changed, but it didn't change that, and actually it was 2007. And this is a characteristic of when someone is, you're winning it, you're doing well by luck, your luck can change. So now let's talk a little bit about conditional probability. Who here has heard of Monty Hall? Almost, okay, so. Briefly, that game was a game where there's three doors or curtains or whatever there were, and behind one of them was a great prize like a car, and behind the other two was a booby prize like a goat. And so Monty would ask you to choose a door, and you choose a door, and then he would open one of the two that you didn't choose. Okay, open that one to show the goat, a goat, and then there's two doors left. And you've had chosen one of them, but now he gives you the chance to switch to the other one. Should you switch or not, or does it not matter? And the intuitive answer is that it doesn't matter. Most people think it doesn't matter, and that's wrong. So it's a good way to illustrate conditional probability. And the reason it doesn't matter is that it's, you think, how could it not matter? It's random. It's 50-50. There's two doors, but it's not random because he opened one of the doors, and when he opened one of the other doors, he chose not to open the door that showed the car. So it's no longer random, or as you might say in mathematics, you've been given more information. Things change, okay, probabilities change when you're given a certain condition, a certain more information, and that's what we have to understand. So here, this diagram kind of shows that. There's three possibilities. So you could have chosen the car, or you could have chosen booby prize A, which I show as a goat, could have chosen booby prize B, which I show as a goat also. So you could have chosen any one of those three. So I call the top number one, let's call that the lucky guess scenario, because you pick the car right off. And in two and three, we'll call them the wrong guess scenario. Okay, and they each have a probability of 1/3. There's three doors. There's a 1/3 chance that you're in either of these. What happens, though, is different. In the lucky guess scenario, Monty truly opens one of the other two doors at random because they're both booby prizes. I don't think he cares which one he shows you. Okay. Or we're going to assume that he doesn't. But in scenario two or scenario three, both of which are wrong guess scenarios, Monty specifically avoids the car and opens the door that you hadn't picked that shows the booby prize, because that's what changes things. Now, if you look at number one, what happens in number one? You chose the car, and the other two are goats. You don't want to switch. It doesn't matter which one he opens, but he opens one of them. If you switch, you lose, okay? In scenario two, where you chose the wrong thing and he opens one of the goats, now you've chosen the other goat. So now if you switch, you win. Okay, it's in scenario two. If you switch, you win. But there's two scenario twos. They're twice as probable as scenario one. So if you don't know what scenario you're in, the chances are twice as great that you're in scenario two. So in the long run, if you keep doing this, you're going to win twice as many times if you switch than if you don't switch. So it might take a little while to digest, but that's the gist of it. Okay, it's in the book. You can take your time. All right, let's relate this to something relevant to life. Okay, so suppose the probability of a false positive on a medical test, say a screening mammogram, is about 10%. So a false positive means the test says you're positive, but you're not really positive. You don't really have the disease. Okay, so the question is, suppose you get a positive test. Okay, that's all you know. The test came back positive. What are the chances that you actually have a tumor? So you might think that since the false positives were 10%, then it's 90. You might think that it's something high, but maybe not 90, say 75. Or you might think that it's this really low number of 9%, and I'm not sure why you'd think that. Maybe I am sure. Okay, first surprise is you can't say, okay? So with what I told you, it could be 0 and it could be 100%. Why is that? Well, suppose that this test has, I said 10% false positives. Suppose that no one in the population has the disease at all, okay? And now it comes back positive. Yes, 10% is a pretty low false positive, but since no one actually has the disease, or in your group that's being tested, let's say, so if it has a 10% false positive rate, but in your group you know that no one has the disease, and it comes back positive, well, guess what? It's got to be a false positive because I told you that no one in your group has the disease, right? And suppose, however, that there's another case where everyone in your group has a disease, okay? So same situation, but now you're in a group where you know everyone has a disease, okay? And you give everyone the test. Again, then when you get a positive rate test, you know that no matter what the false positive rating is, that you have the disease, because I just told you, everyone has a disease. So it's from 0 to 100%, it tells you zero, nothing. You need more information. What you need to know is the incidence of the disease, okay? So you have to compare the false positive rate to the incidence of the disease. So let's assume that about 1% of women, I think this is accurate for women in their 40s, really have breast cancer. And let's assume there's no false negatives, okay, just for simplicity. So you're never going to get a test back that says negative when you really have it. And let's see how this works. Well, doctors like answers A and B. In one study, they one-third chose 90%. In another study, 95% of the doctors said it was about 75%. So you can guess what I'm going to say. Well, can we trust common sense and doctors? From this cartoon, if you can't read it, it says, offhand, I'd say you're suffering from an arrow through your head, but just to play it safe, I'm ordering a bunch of tests. Common sense says it's an arrow, but maybe it's not. So the actual answer is 9%. So why is that? Okay, let's understand that. And this is really, this happened to me personally once where I got, and I wasn't told false positive, I was just told you have this disease. And then, you know, I had to delve into it, and why do you think I have this disease? And the test is never wrong was the answer, you know. One in 1,000 was interpreted as never, but anyway, I don't have the disease, I'd be dead. So how does that work? Well, here it is in English. This is why we need math. The fraction of all those tested who tested positive but aren't is not the same as the fraction of all those who tested positive but aren't. Now, I hope that's confusing. If it's either it's confusing to you or I'm a real idiot, because it's really confusing to me. But if you look at the mathematics or equivalently look at some pictures, I think it becomes clear. So let's do that. So in the top here, we have a model of the population. So I said the incidence was 1 in 100. That's this P here. So there's 100 women here. One has a disease. Now, you look at the other 99, they don't have the disease, but some of them are Ns. They really don't have the disease, right? But some of them, 10% of them will have a false positive. So there's 9.9 of them will get a positive test even though they do not have the disease. So I just round that to 10. So that's these 10 Fs here are the false positives, and the rest are the negatives. So now you can see a picture of it. The chance of the disease is this. The chance of the false positive is this. If you get a positive, look down here. Let's forget all the Ns. They don't matter anymore. We have new information, right? The new information is you just tested positive. Let's just look at the people who tested positive. What are the chances that they're really positive? 1 in 11, okay? So that's really important to keep in mind. I had another friend, it's a long story, but she had the ultrasound and said Down syndrome, and a big debate, you get an amnio test, there's a 1% chance of a spontaneous abortion if you get the amnio test, it's a big decision. And the doctor didn't understand all this, and she was young enough that it didn't make any sense at all to go further because the incidence at that age was very low. When you're older, the incidence of Down syndrome is much higher, so it might make sense to go further with the testing. Okay? The false positive is the same in either case. All right, finally, let's look at some psychological illusions. Many psychological factors that impede our ability to recognize randomness. So one is called the just world illusion. And just world illusion means that you get what you deserve. And here's an example that has to do with your salary. Okay? Who here thinks that people who are paid more, you know, for a given job are better at it and know more than people who are paid less necessarily, let's say? Okay, a little bit more. Someone raise a hand. Okay. Well, you might not think that, but you really do think that. And this study shows this, okay? Here's these two guys, Bill and Ted, having an excellent adventure. Okay. So they even chose them. I like this. They chose them even to look very similar, okay? So the subjects in this experiment were watching Bill and Ted solve anagrams, okay? Well, they really thought they were, but psychologists are really tricky. See, I'd be a very bad subject. I know they always lie. So you thought they were Bill and Ted were two guys solving anagrams, but actually Bill and Ted are actors executing a script to solve anagrams. And the script was designed so they each make equal contributions. One is as good as the other. And not only that, you're not really watching it live as you were told. Of course, they said you're watching it live on this video screen, but it's a tape, so everyone sees the same thing. And anyway, they were also lied to in the following way. The experimenter said, we only have $50. We could only pay one of them or the other. We wanted to pay him $50, so we chose Bill. And half the group, however, were told, we chose Ted. Okay, that's the only difference. So half the group said, and they were told, this is at random. We chose Bill to give $50 to for doing this. And the other group was told at random, we gave Ted the $50, totally at random. It's nothing to do with them, just at random. Okay. Then they watched them solving the anagrams, and they gave the subjects some questions after they watched them solving the anagrams. Well, they said one of the questions was, who was better? Well, who do you think was better? Who do you think they judged to be better? Well, when Bill was being paid, 90% said he was better. And when Ted was being paid, 70% said he was better. So people, even though they know that it's random and they might not even believe that pay has anything to do with their ability, they still make their judgments as if it does. Another one is the expectation bias. So let's start over in that corner. You recognize both of those two by now, right? So who's better, Bill Miller at picking stocks or me? Well, Bill Miller has a lot more going for him and is paid a lot more. I think I've done better lately, but you would expect him to do better because he has a great, very high position, he has the credentials, and he is a smart guy. So we do expectations when we judge what he did. You'd probably, if I said I had a 15-year streak and he said that, you'd probably put more worth on his than on mine. But leave that alone. Let's go to some studies. So this is Coke versus Pepsi. Okay, this is another topic, but there's some interesting recent studies about Coke and Pepsi that find that are influenced, at least these studies are suggestive that they're influenced greatly, not by the taste, but by the image of the drinks, which everyone in advertising knows. But they did MRI studies and looked at what parts of the brain light up when you taste something labeled Coke or Pepsi, and find that the label lights up the pleasure or certain emotional parts of your brain. But that aside, that's just the background. What I'm going to talk about is a study. There have been, I think, more than one of these, of Coke and Pepsi drinkers who say that I either like Coke definitely better or I like Pepsi definitely better, okay? So in this study, they said, okay, great. You have your preference, you have your preferences. Taste these now. Here's the Coke and here's Pepsi. And confirm or say you were wrong. And so they had the people test them, taste them. And then they asked again, now what do you think? Do you like the Coke better or Pepsi better? And I thought, surprisingly, about one-third of them said they were wrong. They actually made a mistake and they liked the other drink better. But the trick was, because they always make a trick, they had put Coke in the Pepsi bottle and Pepsi in the Coke bottle. So actually, two-thirds had gotten it wrong and not even noticed it. But they were following their expectations, and they were probably really were enjoying it more, enjoying their favorite brand more. And the reason I say that will become clear in a second, because this is a wine study here. There's a lot of wine studies about expectations. One is that if you take a white wine and you add a tasteless dye to it to make it look red, and then give it to people and ask them to rate different factors such as the sweetness, they will rate the white wine as sweeter than the red wine. But the study that I want to talk about now is somewhat related to the Coke-Pepsi expectation study. They did a study where this one was not on wine experts, this particular one, but it was on students, Caltech. So maybe they were wine experts in Boone's Farm, if you have that here, but apple wine or strawberry wine, cheap wine. Well, these students were given wines that were labeled by price. And one of the bottles was, for instance, a $90 bottle of wine. It was labeled as $90. But of course, the trick was it was also included in the lineup again, the identical wine, and it was labeled as $10 the other time. And they said, well, which of these wines do you prefer? And no surprise again, they preferred the $90 bottle to the $10 bottle. Well, of course, you know, you'd say, well, sure, they're going to say that. First of all, they'd be afraid not to, because what do they look like if they can't tell the difference? And they might have just felt like saying that. But the trick was they weren't just sitting at a table. They were in an MRI machine having the brains imaged while this was happening. And the brain imaging showed that the pleasure centers of their brain really did light up more when they were drinking the wine as labeled $90 than when they were drinking the same wine and it was labeled $10. So these are real effects. They're not easy to avoid, and they're just ingrained in us. So keep your $90 bottles and keep refilling them with the Boone's Farm. The last study is just a fun one. The New York Times did a blind tasting of vodkas, because we know that you can get a vodka for $12 a fifth, and you're going to get one for $55 or more, and even less than $12 if you want. And the thing about vodkas that's so strange is the definition of vodka is a colorless, tasteless alcohol, right? You look it up. That's the U.S., at least in the U.S., that's the definition, and that's what they have to provide. And they make it all kinds of ways, and all they do is distill it, dilute it, ship it, you know? And so, it's one thing to pay for a fancy wine. I taste the oak, the old shoes. But to pay a lot to say, I don't taste anything. I taste even less. In college, in the chemistry lab, we just go take the ethanol, dilute it with some orange juice, and it'll be good. So anyway, they did a blind tasting of vodkas, and which one won? Guess which one won. So this is such a marketing campaign to make you buy the expensive vodkas. Guess which one won in the New York Times? Smirnoff, which is, I don't know what it is, 15, or it's closer to the lower end. And so I just thought that was an interesting study, and maybe a little take home for you that you get a little benefit out of this talk, okay? Save some money. You're going to save thousands of times more than you paid to be here. Millions of times more. Okay, anchoring. So another factor in our ability to assess data is called anchoring, and this is related to this. Some of you were came a little early, and I did a little test here, and this one is related to that. I did a little test of that test. This shows you how easily your powers of estimation, numerical estimation, are thrown off by irrelevant things that are sticking in your head. Okay. And this is pretty astounding. And this obviously affects your judgment of data. I want to do a little experiment on you, if you don't mind. Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to divide you into two groups, and it's very important that you don't talk. Group two, I guess that's you guys, can you please turn away from the screen? Okay, group one, please read this question to yourself, okay? And record your answer on your little slip of paper. All right, now the other group, you can turn forward again. Thank you. All right, that's good. Now, this group, if you could please turn to the back. Okay, now, you guys who are looking forward, please read this question and record your answer. All right, then
a little, we'll discuss the results of this and the significance of it during the talk. Thanks.
Each of them had the same second question: how many countries are there in Africa? And funny thing happens when you do this. Okay, here's a few random sample of some of the places I've given this test. And so you can see here, group one versus group two, 58. So the first group guessed on average 58 versus 39. Here, 74 versus 26, 65 versus 30. Usually it's about double. The first group guesses about double what the second group guesses. Okay. Let's see what happened here. So we did it here. I have the results. Okay. We had about 100 people participate. So the results are: group one, 73. It's not the highest, but it's up there. And group two, 22. So you guys fit right in. Look at the mean. The means are pretty good, though. There seems to be a problem in Seattle. Something in the water, because they get this exactly the same mean, almost exactly. And your mean is what, 90? No, your mean is about 50. So your mean fits in with these guys, but I don't know about Seattle. And the real answer is, last time I counted, was 54. The wisdom of crowds, I guess. The people who are wrong on one side and the other side, like, self-destruct. But the real question here is, why, right? Why did this happen? What did I do with my magical first silent question that influenced people to answer twice as much, or versus half as much? Well, here's what the first question was. Group one was asked, are there more than 180 countries in Africa? And group two is asked, are there more than 5 countries in Africa? They're probably thinking, what an idiotic question. You know, it's like, what is he getting at? I don't know. And then the second question was, how many? But just the mention of the number 180 versus 5 causes this kind of a change in your. And I probably could have just mentioned the number 180. Just put 180 up there without even having that question, and we've had a similar effect. So that's called anchoring. So obviously, I just have a few examples of where, I mean, if you want to, you know, what you ask for will influence what people think you fairly deserve. So my kids do this, you know, when they ask for money, they double it, figuring out half it, and, you know, it's a game you play, right? And it's true, I've noticed it with myself. Hey, if he had asked for 20, you know, if he had asked for 10, I'd probably have given him 5, but I gave him 10 because he asked for 20. What's going on? You know, it's like. So. The last effect I want to talk about is control. People tend to unconsciously feel that they can control even random events. And again, it's like the other examples I gave you. You can know that it's random and still feel like you can control it. And if you do the right experiment, you can get this will come out. Okay. So this experiment here is, this picture is some Yale students on the left, and the right side is a picture of some money, pretty accurately, I think. And these Yale students were taken one by one and asked to watch coin flips and predict the results. Okay. Now, if you had asked them explicitly, could you predict or control the results of these coin flips, I'm sure they would have said no. I don't think it was in the paper. But the question is, do they really believe that they can foretell coin flips or not? Well, if you ask them slightly more subtle questions and they get their guard down, an interesting thing happens. You start to see that they really think they can. And so two of the questions that they asked were, I mean, they're very thinly veiled, okay? That's why you can't ask beforehand, do you think you can predict coin flips? Because they have to be totally off guard and not thinking about these issues consciously. But they asked the question, would you improve with practice? Well, if they're random, probably not, right? Would distraction impede your performance? And you had 25% to the first question, 40% said yes to the second question. It's a famous study. But, you know, when I first read this, I said, what did she do, pay him off, you know? But there's many studies like that, and they all point to the same thing. I can talk about that later. I'm not going to go on too long. But there's some other really cute studies where they show the same. Okay, one. Just one. This is so fun. You got a card in a bag. It could be one of 4 cards, okay? And they say that you get, let's say you get $4 if your card matches the card that's in the bag. There's 4 cards. One of them is in a bag. I mean, one of those 4 is in the bag. If yours matches, you get $4. Then they divide people into two groups. One group, you give them a card and say, if your card matches, you get $4. Do you want to sell it back to me? How much do you want for it? The other group, they get to pick whichever card of the four that they want. And if it matches, they get the $4. So they have control. They can pick the card. Of course, they know that they can't guess what's in the thing. It's just random, but they get to pick it. They ask for four times more on average for their card to sell it back than the other group that was given the card. I mean, it's astounding, but that's the way people are. So, okay, the final study, just to show how your mind works, is it's called red-green, it's called matching, probability matching or probability guessing, but the subjects are shown red and green lights. And they're flashing without any pattern, but let's say the red light flashes 3 out of 4 times and the green light flashes 1 out of 4 times. So the subjects watch this for a while and they are asked to guess what's going to be next, red or green. So they watch it for a while and they eventually pick up, red is more, they say red, yeah, red is flashing more. It's flashing maybe 3 out of 4 times, okay. And then they start guessing whether it's red or green, and they guess red 3 out of 4 times and green 1 out of 4 times. Well, if you put a rat in the same experiment, the rat will go, the red one is coming more. I'm going to guess red, red, red every time. And, you know, by doing that, if you compare the two strategies, the rat wins, okay? So, the rat did not invent physics, so we have some advantages over the rat. But we look for patterns, and we try to understand their meaning. We assign them meanings, and we think we can control them. And lower animals sometimes don't, but it also sometimes gets us into trouble. So I've talked about the three illusions relating to randomness, how in life we don't have enough data to make the judgments that we do, how the inclusion of new factors changes things, and the psychology behind it. So just leave you with, there's many messages in the book. I think they're hopeful messages. It might sound negative. You're saying we can't judge this, we can't judge that, but really one of the hopeful things I'm saying is that if things go badly for you, don't assume that you're bad, or you're never going to succeed, that you're busy, you're bad at business, you're bad at science, whatever, you're a bad writer. Harry Potter was rejected 7 or 8 times. It's not always easy for people to recognize something that's good or that will be successful beforehand. It's easy after, right? John Grisham's books were rejected many, many times. Dr. Seuss's books. There are many stories of that. There's stories of this is just in the book world, but the London Times sending famous books to agents and publishers and under a incognito, so to speak, and they were rejected. And they were award-winning, very popular books. So when you get, because there's this element of randomness in life, when something doesn't work out for you, it doesn't mean that you got it wrong. It also doesn't mean that even if you do more or less have it wrong, but there's some small chance that you can succeed, that it won't happen if you keep trying. So you have to keep trying. And on the other hand, if you're everything's going well for you, you're one of the Bill Gateses of the world, you shouldn't necessarily think that, or you shouldn't think that you're necessarily the smartest person or most able person. You have to realize the role of circumstances and luck. And I wish I could say more about it, but let me end with a short quote by Thomas Watson, one of the pioneers at IBM. This is one of my favorite quotes. He said, "If you want to succeed, double your failure rate." Thank you.
Would you kindly observe where I'm sitting? I was amongst the last 5 in the waiting list.
I'm sorry, you were?
I was amongst the last 5 in the waiting list. Oh. And you observe where I'm sitting. What are the chances of my repeating this thing?
This shows the power of active pursuit of your goals. And I'm all for that. If you're on the last 5 of the waiting list, bring your own chair and sit in front.
Hi, would you comment on randomness and prayer / religion?
Sure. What I'm going to say now, express his views. So aim that way.
My My parents won't like my views, so I'll keep them to myself.
I'll say this, that there have been studies, your government dollars at work of the health of people who are being prayed for and other surveys, and they do tend to show that there's no use in that in terms of praying for the Mets to win the World Series or the Cubs, which I do regularly, and that shows you how good that is. Cub fans? All right. One? All right. All right. Blue Jays fans? So, I wish we could just do the Coke and Pepsi switch on the Cubs and the Blue Jays this year. We'd be okay, but they'd probably go down fast. Prayer helps people who are being prayed for, and knowing that people care about you helps. But, when it's been studied scientifically, and it hasn't been overly studied, there hasn't been. And I think that the first, I think it was the Romans who first noticed that. I'm thinking of astrology, where it may have been Cicero who said, hey, if this astrology stuff works, how come these guys who just got clobbered, had good signs? And so people have noticed for a long time that doesn't, but then why treat it as science?
Maybe a strange question. To ask you, is there a system, mechanical or mathematical, that can bring randomness into order?
Well, any time you take something that's, say, uncontrolled or, and get under control, then, if I take the right drug or whatever that make my, be able to control my thumb better, or even just practice a hell of a lot, I maybe could do that.
I mean, 200%?
Generically, I don't think you can say it generically that there's some Star Trek device that does it.
You talked a little bit about psychology and how people's minds influence how they choose, even if they think they know that it's random. Why do you think that people have a tendency to assume for the worst?
Well, that's my mother. I don't know if everybody's like that. I'm not like that. So maybe it's not even genetic. I don't know. I think some people assume for the best and some people assume for the worst. And they do have a tendency to see patterns. And maybe if they're, if they've seen patterns leading that way, they think the future is going to reflect that, or is going to continue to follow that. But otherwise, I don't think I have any particular insights.
Okay, a couple more questions. One right here.
Hi, I wanted to ask you a little bit about clutch hitting.
About what?
Clutch hitting.
Clutch hitting.
Sort of like the
sure.
hot hand. You mentioned something about climate or current climate affecting randomness. Is that something that could affect clutch hitting? I know there have been studies where over large numbers, clutch hitting actually cancels out, but could there be players that actually have the psychology to actually perform better during the clutch?
Theoretically,
or goalies or something like that in a playoff?
You would think that there would be, but no study has ever found them. I think the DiMaggio streak was one that people had analyzed and thought was of that type, which is kind of clutch hitting because every day you have to get a hit, but no one has found that. I mean, theoretically, there's no reason that you can't, but maybe the point is that when you're a professional player, you're more or less immune to that, and you're a professional, and you don't react to the nervousness of the situation so much. And if it was a small effect, again, in a season's records, you I don't know how many times you get into a clutch situation, but it might not even show itself. But I'm not aware that anyone has ever found that to be true. And I know a lot of, there were cases where they've looked.
With so much randomness in our world, much of which we attribute to an explanation, how do we turn it around and say, this isn't random? Because a lot of things we can't do the numbers of probability that you suggest. So how can we distinguish in our own life between what is truly random on an ongoing basis versus the things that are due to good judgment or other factors? And then in line with that, what is the probability that everything that we're doing, in fact, is random? And it doesn't matter.
Well, if you tell a joke every time and no one ever laughs, it's probably not random, it's probably deterministic. And that's a strange thing to pop into my mind, because when I did write for Hollywood at one time, I thought about maybe writing some stand-up stuff. And I had this crazy physicist idea that I wrote my like 50 jokes, and I took them to all my friends and said, read these jokes and tell me which ones are funny. You know, and I took a poll, kind of, which was kind of, and the, you know, it was pretty random, something like this. I'm like, you know, plus after number five, no one really cared anymore. This one, like, so you know.
That should have been.
I don't know why I keep, this is random. I keep going like this, and this thing's not even on. You guys are making me crazy. So, okay, the definition of randomness I gave was that the same thing always happens. So if you see the same thing always happening, then it's not random. Of course, you can't ever know. And I had this discussion once with a visiting mathematician who was very religious and claimed that, you know, that there's no such thing as randomness, because randomness itself is a kind of perfection. You build a die, it's supposed to be 1/6 on each time, land on each side 1/6 of the time, and he said that you can't do that without imperfections. And we talked about quantum mechanics, where it is built into the world. But if the same thing always happens, then it's probably not, there's no random component to it. But it doesn't mean that it's going to happen again, because that's against statistics. If you observe the sun has risen, you know, 10,000 times, that means it'll probably, you have a good confidence that it's not, it's going to, there's a reason for it, and it's going to arise, and there's no uncontrollable factors that will make it not rise tomorrow. But that's not 100% guaranteed. And in fact, if you live billions of years, you'll see that one day it doesn't. In fact, it engulfs you.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.